that the Israeli economy depends for its import flow on ships. It depends for its export earnings on tourism and on diamonds, which are easily transportable by air, but which, in the case of tourism, has completely ground to a halt by war. So the Israeli civilian economy is in a serious shape in its ability to earn money from tourism. It's in serious shape from its ability to import and export through the ports. It faces the prospect of a very long war with a very large mobilization of men and women in the army. So it's desperately short of workforce. It can no longer employ Palestinians as cheap labor, so construction grinds to a halt. It has faced the evacuation of most people, most farming, most productive enterprises in the north of the country under Hezbollah threat. It has faced the evacuation of the same in the south and along the wall to Gaza. So you've got a small country for the first time facing, for the very first time in its history, a long war with multiple Arab fronts. It has never faced before. And for the first time, the Arabs hold an initiative the Israelis can beat their chest about, but can't defeat.
Yeah, well, I'm casting around a little bit here, John. Usually, when we speak, we're speaking about a single article. You've written so many articles that I'm lost in the figures of them all. But I'm pretty sure in my notes I've got that Israel receives 99% of its goods via sea routes, 54% of those coming up the Red Sea and going through either to Ashdod or Ayat, or through the Suez Canal. And with both of those closed off right now, that's more than half of their imports cut, at least their seabound imports being interrupted right
Yes.
now.
Thanks for remembering the numbers, Chris. I can't manage to hold them all in my head at once.
No, there's too much here, and I'm always amazed at just the amount of information you put out. But John, there's something else in another of your articles here. Now, there's another connection. There's been some intimation that Gibraltar itself might, because the Mediterranean is the only alternative to the Suez and to the Red Sea ports that are being affected, that there's a possibility that that avenue might too come under attack, and Israel could find themselves not being able to receive that supply or that supply line being shut down. How is that possible?
Well, we won't get into how to do it militarily. What we can say is that that there's been an implied threat from both Houthi spokesmen and from Iran that as the war continues and as the casualty rate of the Israeli genocide in Gaza continues to rise, without relief, without help, without blockaded, Gaza's blockaded. Israel is now beginning to be blockaded. What can be done is essentially rather small. If a firecracker were lobbed onto an Israeli vessel passing through Gibraltar and did no damage, but simply demonstrated what can be done by the Arab militaries against Israeli shipping or Western shipping trying to assist Israel. If that happens once, twice, or three times without damage, without killing anybody on the vessel, but simply to prove that it can be done, that Gibraltar is no longer safe for Israel and no longer safe for the alliance supporting the genocide. That can be done. There are many Arab states, Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, Libya, all within shooting range of Gibraltar. As I say, it doesn't have to be an expensive long-range ballistic missile. It doesn't have to be a long-range or even a short-range drone with an explosive warhead. It simply has to be an ordnance with a firecracker to demonstrate what will be done if the world, the Western world, the European world, continues to support a genocide, we say. And exactly how it can be done by the Arab militaries is something that's up to them, and they're not going to tell me, and I'm not going to tell everybody because I don't know. But the facts are obvious, the threat's on the table, and the strategic reason for employing, let's call it, the "we can do this to you if you do not stop the genocide" strategy is obvious. If it's obvious, it's going to happen.
Well, and it needn't even be state supported. We've seen in Gaza the effectiveness of drones. These small drones are affordable to almost anybody. And when you're dealing with shorter range, delivering small packages of high explosives, who knows what could happen? You mentioned in one of your articles about the Indian flagged motor vessel Sai Baba being attacked hundreds of miles to the east in the Indian Ocean. The U.S. CENTCOM reported on that attack and on some anti-ballistic missiles fired in the Red Sea from Yemen as well. But do we know who's responsible for that? I mean, it seems out of range for any but a shipboard or a ship released drone. Yeah.
The question of who's responsible is difficult, and that's beyond my capacity to give a confident answer, Chris. And bear in mind that...
But nobody's claimed it.
As I understand it, the Houthis have not disclaimed and not claimed. The distances involved for a drone are roughly 1,600 kilometers. That's at the very limit of anything known in the Houthi arsenal. The U.S. Central Command, which publishes its propaganda by Twitter and by press release, has claimed these Arabian Sea incidents were caused by a missile or drone firings from Iranian territory, which is, I think, roughly 500 to 600 kilometers to the east. However, there is an Iranian intelligence gathering vessel, the Safiz, in the Arabian Sea, and it is within range, short drone range of these vessels that were struck in the last 3 or 4 days. So the Indian media, which you have to remember, involves a lot of anti-Muslim sentiment. The Indian media have been claiming that the attacks came essentially from the Saviz, though they don't spell the vessel right, and they're not too interested in following up what the Saviz is doing there. Saviz is a general cargo carrier that's been refitted in Iran for intelligence collection purposes, electronic surveillance, radar, and satellite connection and all the rest. But it's got plenty of room for a team to fire drones at Israeli-connected cargoes that pass by. So the Iranians have created the capacity for anonymous proxy drone attacks as far away from Iran and the Yemen coast as 200 nautical miles off the Indian coast as these incidents record. So because they're proxy attacks, because we're at war in the dark, because Iran and Houthi tactics are not hand in hand, as the Western press want to say, but exactly how they're coordinated is their military secret, just as Israeli cooperation with the United States is their military secret. Because of all of this intentional darkness and camouflage, we can't be sure. What we can be sure of is the dramatic impact on all shipping, and that affects all of us. So impact from these dark events is very bright and visible.
Yeah, you've written another article. You mentioned the Beshad in the Red Sea, and in the article that you wrote, "Honey Trap for the Israelis and Americans in the Red Sea," you talk about past commando attacks by Israel on Iranian shipping that is, you know, non-military or observational, I guess in this case. As well, but in this article, what do you mean by a honey trap for Israelis? What would the Iranians have to gain from leaving a sucker ship out there to be served as a target for Israel and or America?
Well, again, at that point in time, the Beshad was sitting at anchor in the southern sector of the Red Sea without any guard, and. Mm. The story I did it at that time, just before Christmas, indicated that the sister ship of the Beshad, the Saviz, had been in roughly the same location when it was hit by an Israeli commando attack, which was intended to sink it, but it failed. There were limpet mine explosives used, there were detonations. The ship was damaged, and Iran sent tugs to tow the vessel back to Iran, where it was repaired and refitted. The Saviz is now redeployed, as we've just said, eastward in the Arabian Sea. That left on that day the Beshad. Why would it be sitting there, since for the last 2.5 years, the Iranians know, the maritime industry knows, the Israelis know, it's a sitting duck for another attack? Answer, some of my sources were saying, since 2021, when the Saviz was attacked, the Iranians have obviously and prudently moved their surveillance onshore to secret locations less vulnerable to Israeli or American attack. That would be on Yemen territory. And the Israelis are a little bit more reluctant to attack on Yemen territory, not least because they may be far less successful than they like to think they are. Therefore, what said one of the sources, is the Beshad sitting there unaccompanied, unguarded? Is it a honey trap? Is it an attempt to draw an Israeli-American attack, essentially on Iran? The Beshad is Iran. If Israel attacks Iran, Iran's then directly involved. This war between Israel and Iran, involving assassinations of Iranians, like an American assassination attempts, like the Soleimani murder, targeting individuals, Iranians involved in their nuclear program, in their military program, and there was a devastating attack by Israel in Damascus the other night, which killed the Iranian coordinator of operations in Syria. So there's this undeclared war. The Beshad is much more visible and was on that day, to one of the sources I was talking to and to whom I reported, a honey trap, an attempt to lure both Americans and Israelis into a direct attack on Iran, which expands the war and suddenly makes it the one war that everybody says, even on the Israeli alliance, shouldn't happen, an expanded regional war. Well, since then, the situation has changed. And as I already said in this program, said late yesterday, the Iran Navy has moved a missile-armed frigate to guard the Beshad. And you can see that in the Russian map. I asked myself, and I asked the readers of the piece and listeners now, where does this Russian map come from? You can't get from any, pardon me, Western source, a map of the deployment of naval vessels in the area. And you can't readily get it from satellite, commercial satellite companies. This map appears in a Russian military blogger's publication, and it's appearing twice now. The new location for the Alborz, which is the Iranian Navy frigate now guarding the Beshad, changes the story. It isn't a honey trap any longer. It's a very, it's a well-guarded, missile-guarded installation. That changed the honey trap story. But it raises another question. The Russian military intelligence, I believe, is providing real-time information through a military blog source that nobody else watches. Well, Russians do. I've tried to make it visible to everybody. The political implications are that the honey trap isn't a honey trap anymore. It's a fortified object.
Yeah, and your source says, and you quote that source as saying that the Beshad is a honey trap, but I've no idea what response to the Iranians, Russians, and Chinese have formulated if there is an attack on the Beshad or on another ship, maybe a Chinese ship. The false flag is always a possibility, but the idea would be that Iran is eager to draw Russia and China more closely into this, something that both those countries are not anxious to do, presumably.
Well, let me qualify that. First of all, there are three Chinese Navy vessels at berth in at their big military base in Djibouti on the Red Sea, and they have tremendous advanced radar and early warning and missile guidance and tracking capabilities at that base. So they're doing their level best to understand what everybody else is doing. Whether they share it with Iran, whether they share it with anyone else, I don't know. At the same time, Russia has satellite and long-range surveillance capabilities. How much they're sharing with the Iranians, I don't know. The issue inside Russia, and this is a very important issue we haven't touched on, is that the Russian military, the general staff, the defense ministry, have a direct and cooperative and intimate military supply, military tactics relationship, military strategy relationship with Iran. It's involved, according to the Western press, the supply of Iranian drones for Russian military use in the Ukraine. But that's not all. The relationship is going both ways. On the other hand, at the Kremlin, there is the line that's relatively cool politically to Iranian commitment to the defense of Palestine and the Iranian opposition towards Israel. And we wrote about that when the President Raisi of Iran was in Moscow to meet President Putin, and there was a large delegation of officials from both sides. For the time being, publicly, President Putin does not endorse the Iranian or Arab view of what the Israelis are doing. He is advocating humanitarian aid and so forth and so on. He's discussed the so-called two-state solution, while the military judgment and the Russian general opinion is much more hostile to Israel and no longer sees a two-state solution as a possible outcome, not least of all because the Israeli military and the Israeli political leadership and their entire population in public opinion polls – reject the two-state solution in favor of the genocide and displacement of the Arabs. So there is a political gap between the Kremlin line and the defense and military cooperation between Russia and Israel's enemies. And this is not public in Russia. It's not discussed in detail in the Russian military blogs. And there are many reasons for this domestically. Russia is in a presidential election campaign now. The election, which President Putin will win, is on March 17. Until then, there is a great sensitivity on the part of the Kremlin and Putin's election managers to avoid any public display of hostility towards Israel and Russian Jews. The reason for this is clear. There has already been one protest at Makhachkala Airport when a flight from Israel stopped in Makhachkala in Dagestan, a Muslim republic of the Russian Federation in the Caucasus. And there was a public demonstration against Jewish Israelis. There's a very considerable concern that Russian sentiment, popular Russian sentiment, against the combination of Israeli state genocide, Zionist ideology, and Jewish religious belief would trigger an intercommunal protest. And Putin doesn't want any such thing, at least during the election period. And afterwards, Putin has been very clear in his public statements that Russia is a multicultural, multi-faith federation and won't tolerate intercommunal violence. That's a priority now.
Well, it must put him between a rock and a hard place. Putin has been perceived as being soft on Israel in the past. Israel has shot down Russian aircraft. They have attacked Israel's ally, Syria. The assassination that you mentioned, Saeed Razi Mousavi, pardon my pronunciation, the Iranian general, as you said, he was a number one general in Syria for Iran, coordinating military assistance between the two countries, assassinated, what was it, yesterday or the day before yesterday? And I would think that would be enough provocation for Iran, but they've been repeatedly provoked, especially in Syria and Lebanon, with their generals being targeted, and also their scientists before that, even murdered within Iran.
That's right. The Russian military view about the Israeli use of air power outside of Israel, in Lebanese airspace, in Syrian airspace, to attack so-called Iranian targets, the Russian military view of that is that they are prohibited from using their air defense capability to deter or attack Israeli incursions into Syrian airspace. That's a political decision, a political foot on the Russian military brake in Syria. It's the reason President Putin is and has been soft on Israel. There's no doubt about it. The explanation for it, however, has not materialized, and we haven't the time, and I haven't the competence at this moment or the evidence to understand the nature of that softness. I do understand, as I've just explained, why Russian sentiment, which is pro-Arab, pro-Palestinian, and against the Jewish, Zionist, and Israeli state genocide, why Russian sentiment cannot be expressed in public for fear of an intercommunal protest disrupting a peaceable election campaign. That's the tactical short-term rule in Russia at the moment, and it extends to blackouts in the Russian media debating these very issues. What is the relationship between Jewish religious belief, Zionist ideology, and Israeli state genocide? That's not allowed to be discussed in the Russian press, and so it's not. Go on.
No, I don't want to interrupt, John, but we are fast running out of time.
Well, just to say that that's a very sensitive issue, which is, pardon me, the whole question of what's anti-Semitism when Palestinians, Arabs are Semites and Jews claim to be Semites is also an issue of great importance, of great sensitivity, that's not being discussed in Russia. Frankly speaking, it's not widely discussed anywhere in the Western alliance, because the theory of anti-Semitism portrayed there is its hostility to only the Jewish religious community and not to the Arab race. We are seeing Jewish religious support in the name of Jewish religion, Zionist ideology, and Israeli state policy to kill all the inhabitants of Gaza or displace them to make God's own territory what it was allegedly in biblical times. And we've seen people like Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, and many others citing the Israeli version of the Bible as the original Israelite tribes took control by destroying of the territories now called Israel or Palestine by killing the inhabitants, wiping them out. The biblical references to that we don't have the time for, but these are highly sensitive debates which we can't have at the rear end of a post-Christmas, pre-New Year program. It'll be something we'll come to later, because the implications of a religion lining up behind a genocide, the implications of that we haven't faced in historical time for centuries. We are now facing it. So the first thing to do in the Western press, on the radio waves of the West, is not to address it at all.
Well, clearly the Christian religious holiday has been utilized as a cover or distraction for that ethnic cleansing and genocide, as it's been widely determined and interpreted as being 250 more people, more than that, actually killed just in the last 24 hours in central Gaza. The squeeze pushing the population further and further south is going on. Hospitals are still being blown up. These last hundreds killed just outside the gates of one of the last remaining operating hospitals in Gaza. It beggars all description right now. You're quite right, John. We don't have time to do all that. Remember to go to John's website, Dances with Bears. You can find it at johnhelmer.net. Your output has been prolific, as I said earlier, and it's sadly needed, because we're not getting a lot of intelligent coverage certainly not in the main presses, but even in the alternative press too, it's pretty scant. Thanks a lot, John, for coming on again, and I wish we could cover this more, and I hope we get a chance to do so in the new year, but I know you're taking some holiday time off, well deserved. We'll talk to you perhaps in January.
Thank you very much, Chris. I wish all the Guerrilla Radio listeners a well-informed new year. It's hard to know that it'll be a happy one, but Guerrilla Radio will be one of the few voices, platforms, and bandwidths you can follow in Canada to understand what's happening before it happens to us. Let's hope for the best, and let's at least understand if it's the worst, why it's coming for us and what we can do about that. So happy new year to you, Chris, and thanks for having me.
Very gracious, John. Thank you. And that's all I got for now. Till the next time. When nothing is as it's presented.
It's a bit like discovering that your favorite uncle that's taken you for walks in the park, however, that he's really a serial abuser.
You need a different source. Guerrilla Radio, a century of news every Thursday and Saturday.